Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks for joining us this Sunday morning ahead of your Christmas holiday. We bring you tidings of great radio this morning in the way of stories from Dayton Youth Radio, Culture Couch, and Veterans Voices. Also ahead, health news from Side Effects Public Media. Up first. It's been almost 7 months since an outbreak of tornadoes caused tens of millions of dollars in damage, displacing people across the Miami Valley. Since then, an army of government agencies, volunteers, and advocates have been working to help restore hard-hit communities. And one recent event aimed to provide a boost to storm-affected families ahead of the holidays. In a packed hall at the Gateway Cathedral Church in Trotwood, around 40 families, mostly women and children, gathered to share a meal. Some eat chicken dinner with sides of cooked corn, green beans, and dinner rolls. Others have already moved on to desserts like chocolate cake and cookies. The room is buzzing with conversation and excitement, and there's a feeling of Christmas in the air. Jason Bunger is pastor of Hope Church in Dayton. The church partnered with Gateway to host the event. He says each year they try to assess the biggest need facing Dayton residents and how the congregation could help meet that need.
And so we recognize everything we've been through this year. We've had the unrest at the beginning of the year. We had the Dayton shootings, and we had the Memorial Day tornadoes. And we recognize that many people, because they were hit by the tornadoes, are probably not going to be able to celebrate Christmas. And so we said, what can we do?
The church has partnered to identify the 40 or so families affected by the May tornadoes. The families were told they'd be having dinner and receiving donated toys for the children. But then, something they didn't expect.
We are so glad you are here tonight. And so we have a special presentation that we want to make. So here's what's going to happen. Each family that came in was given a green ticket. Have your green ticket ready. Pastor Norman is going to call names. When he calls your name, hold that ticket high. And one of these lovely teenagers are going to run to you and give you an envelope and take your green ticket. Okay? Don't open that envelope until everybody's received theirs. Okay? Promise, I will not open the envelope. I love it.
As names are called, two young men run an envelope out to each of the families, where, as instructed, they wait. Once each family has their envelope, they wait for the count of three to open them.
One, 7, 2, 3.
Then, reaction. Mixed emotions mark the faces of those gathered. While many wave their envelopes high in the air and cheer, others hold them close and weep. Inside each envelope is a $600 Christmas gift card. The churches raised $27,000 to make this night happen. The dinner, the gift cards, and still to come, presents for the children. Families exiting the hall after dinner offered emotional reactions. Among them is Teresa Smith. She says she's still struggling with difficult memories from the night of the storm. The Harrison Township resident says she was asleep on her couch when the tornado hit her neighborhood.
I thought I heard sirens, and I turned the TV on, and it said, if you live in the Harrison Township area, get into your safe place like now. I didn't have 2 minutes, and it was there, and I ran to the basement and held on for my life.
When it was over, Smith's house was still standing, but it was missing part of the roof and a few walls. Her car was also damaged.
Today I got a roof over my house.
You got a little bit of help tonight as well?
Yes, oh my God. Yes, oh, I'm speechless. I feel so blessed and grateful.
For Constance Iannaccio, being in the church and receiving the surprise donation was overwhelming. Her home in Trotwood was damaged by the May storms. She attended the dinner with her three young children.
So I was so happy. I didn't expect it to be this way. This is a time of sharing, a time of giving, a time of love, and I felt the love this night.
With most of the families gone, church staff and volunteers start breaking down tables. Gateway Cathedral pastor Norman Scarce's home and church were hit in the tornado. During the storm, he huddled with his wife and children in the bathtub of their Troutwood home. Tonight's event, he says, holds special significance.
To see the responses of the individuals that were blessed tonight was worth more than anything we could have ever imagined.
Hundreds of storm-affected families around the Miami Valley continue to rebuild their homes and their lives. But church organizers hope community events like this one will help make this Christmas just a little better for tornado survivors in need. For WISO, I'm Jerry Kenney. Military veterans are often modest about their accomplishments and the lasting contributions of their service. Today on Veterans Voices, Sam Eckenrode talks to Air Force veteran Malcolm Kelly. They're both from Yellow Springs and have known each other a long time. But Eckenrode finds that she's still learning new things about Kelly's career.
Malcolm, I think I've known you since I was about 10, and you were always sort of in the background. And it wasn't until maybe, I don't know, a couple months ago, I realized that you had retired from the Air Force. And did you, when you were little, did you dream of one day being in the Air Force?
Nope, not at all.
You told me that there was something, a stock answer you always give when people ask, what are the most interesting things you did in the Air Force?
Well, gee, there's so many. Basically, getting thrown in the deep end with unsolvable problems and having to come up with some way to do it and successfully doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was a munitions officer. I initially assigned to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base with the B-52s, where it was during the Vietnam War, 1969, 1970. It worked out okay. I went to Korea, where I was the wing weapon safety officer. From there, I went to England with the F-111 units. That's the aircraft that was designed to be a threat to Moscow. It goes at Mach 1 or higher at 100 feet off the deck. Russia didn't have anything to counter that.
And was your title the same all along, or did you keep changing titles?
It was basically wing weapon safety officer in each case. What I was doing was I would go out, find a problem that had never been acknowledged, and devise a solution to it.
Well, what were some of the problems that you came up with?
Well, one of the overreaching ones that affect virtually everyone is hot cockpits from the sun.
Mm-hmm.
Well, nobody can turn the sun off,
right?
So you can't solve that. Well, yes, you can. With cockpit solar shields.
Mm-hmm.
I developed a design after much thrashing around and came up with designs for virtually every airplane. Lowered temperatures by 60 to 80 degrees on the inside. And it's been estimated that the savings from my two-year, $200,000 part-time, one-man project saves $440 million a year.
Wow.
To date, that's about $8 billion.
Not
a bad thing.
Quite an accomplishment.
Yeah.
Well, I really appreciate your willingness to come and talk to me today. It's been fascinating. Thank you, Malcolm.
Thank you.
That was Air Force veteran Malcolm Kelly and Sam Eckenrode of Yellow Springs. This conversation took place at WISO as part of StoryCorps' Military Voices Initiative, which visited the Miami Valley last summer. Veterans Voices on WISO is presented by WrightPath Credit Union. With additional support from CareSource, the story was edited by Jim Kale and Will Davis. Up next on WISO Weekend, the Dayton Art Institute has been celebrating its centennial all year, and right now they're showcasing the photography of William Preston Mayfield. Mayfield became famous while the DAI was being built. He's one of the earliest and most prolific aerial photographers. Having flown with the Wright brothers, he's also Dayton's most famous photojournalist. He spent six decades taking pictures in the Gem City. For Culture Couch, here's a story from Community Voices producer Jason Reynolds.
William Preston Mayfield led a fantastic life. He learned to take photos when he was 9. He talked the Dayton Daily News into a job when he was 12. By his early teens, he became the first person to take a photograph from an airplane. Catherine Reichman Sigworth, the photography curator at DAI, says it took some time for Mayfield to gain the Wright brothers' trust.
He had been on assignment for Dayton Daily News to go out to Huffman Prairie to take photographs of the Wright brothers, but it was when he was 14 he finally convinced Orville Wright to take him up in the plane.
Here, it's important to remember that early Wright brothers' planes were nothing like today's planes. They were made of wood and canvas. There was no cabin, no interior at all, no seat belts. And Mayfield's camera was nothing like today's cameras. It was basically a gigantic wooden box that could only take one photo at a time. So he had to hold that big old box out over the wing.
The story goes he was terrified. It was a cold November morning, and Orville pointed down at the flight hangar and said, "Take a photo." And with the one negative he had, took that photo.
Ironically, the Dayton Daily News didn't want to run the photo. Sigworth says since there weren't any people in the photograph, the newspaper didn't see much value in it. But Mayfield did. By the mid-20s, he would go on barnstorming tours. He'd grab a pilot and go from city to city, renting planes, taking photos, and selling them for a hefty profit. He was also a photojournalist. For 6 decades, he took photos of Dayton's most important events and landmarks. All those old black-and-white photos create a compelling visual history of Dayton that's on display in this exhibit. Sigworth says one of her favorites is a photo of the DP&L steam plant on 3rd Street downtown. She says it goes from deceptively simple to comically complex if you examine the side of the plant's tall smokestack and see that a handful of people are on it, hamming it up for the camera.
It just looks like an industrial scene, but if you look closely, you can see all the men on the smokestack, and they all have one leg into the ladder, but then the other leg out with their arms on their hips in this row of succession, maybe 6 people. And it just shows that it's an elegant yet fun commissioned photograph.
They're like industrial rockets.
Yes, exactly.
That old industrial steam plant was recently renovated and turned into a posh private event center. It's pretty easy for Daytonians to play a game of now and then or guess that building when going through this exhibit. One photo is of a line of 15 women standing with their bicycles in front of the Davis Sewing Building. It's a bit of foreshadowing. The Davis Sewing Machine Company would eventually morph into Huffman Corporation, which made it big with Huffy Bikes. The bike company left that building on Linden Avenue in East Dayton years ago. These days, it's mostly artist lofts. Jan Underwood spent decades working as a photographer for the Dayton Daily News, so she is uniquely qualified to address Mayfield's work as both art and craft.
I'm a photojournalist, so to me, history and documentation are at the core of what I do. But every photographer strives for an image that catches the eye and captivates the imagination, and I guess that's what art is.
There's no shortage of history in the photos on display at DAI. There's parades at the end of World War I, crowds gathered in the streets to listen to the World Series on a radio, a photo of the famous female pilot, Ruth Law, and one of the media mogul, James Cox. Some of the most moving photos are of Dayton tragedies. There's one of an old downtown hotel, the Beckel, that caught fire. Black smoke bellows from its windows. There's a tangle of hoses out on the street.
Here we have a photograph of people gawking at the hotel fire, the big long fire engine, the cable cars.
Underwood says what makes a great photo, like the Beckel hotel print, is when the camera captures people's reactions to an event.
It's how it affects people that is important. And here you can see that hundreds of people came to watch this fire.
There is, of course, a photo of homes damaged and destroyed by the flood of 1913. And there's a photo of hundreds of people gathered at the courthouse on 3rd and Main for a flood relief fundraiser after the waters finally subsided. At the end of this difficult year, when Dayton saw a mass shooting traumatize one neighborhood and tornadoes destroy others, it's all too easy to relate to the Daytonians and that photo taken over 100 years ago. For Culture Couch at WYSO, I'm Jason Reynolds.
And in keeping with the arts, last month a prison theater group at Marion Correctional Institution performed The Hamilton Project, 23 songs from the hip-hop musical about the life of Alexander Hamilton. Community Voices producer David Seitz visited Marion to learn what it means to tell Hamilton's story from inside a prison.
The men in Theater of Conviction at Marion Correctional have tackled big ideas before, including Hamlet. It was after that performance that they approached their director, Jesse Glover, a theater professor from Otterbein University, and said, "Hey, when are we going to do Hamilton?"
And I said, "No. Let's do something else." Because I was scared of that idea.
For Glover, the show was too big for a prison stage. Instead, she led a class focused on the musical where the men studied the history, the musical styles, and the play's themes. And the men kept pushing. Catherine Roma leads a choir with the same men and offered to direct the music.
I started saying, "I think this is possible." And I knew that their interest was really high because they had had this course.
The group decided to highlight the idea of prison and control. They brought that out in the song "The Room Where It Happens," when Aaron Burr is shut out of the backroom deals between Hamilton and Jefferson. Here's Glover.
Many of the men have said, you know, that they resonate with this idea of wanting to be in the room where it happens, the room where decisions are made, and never really being able to.
Nobody knows how the game is played, the art of the trade, how the sausage gets made.
The men also wanted to portray the complexity of men's relationships in prison. So their version of Hamilton focused on the rivalry between Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr that leads to their famous duel. Here's Tron. That's his nickname in prison. He plays Hamilton.
So you got Jefferson against Hamilton. You got Burr against Hamilton and so forth. So it's always these, they're butting heads all the time, you know, but they're all trying to climb to a next level in their careers and life. And you just see a lot of aggression coming out, even to the point of murder.
Tron is a talented rap composer and is planning on using music to support community development. He identifies with Hamilton's ambitions for himself and society.
When he's thinking about America in that way and how he can restructure things and bring people up to a higher place, especially financially, and just how they view America, that's how I view the communities that I come from. So I just want to bring them up to a whole nother level, and that scares me because it's so much responsibility. Then it takes so much discipline.
I'm past patiently waiting, I'm passionately smashing every expectation, every action's an act of creation. I'm laughing in the face of casualties and sorrow. For the first time, I'm thinking past tomorrow.
Tron also understands the nearness of death in Hamilton's life. He recalls these lines from the play.
I imagine death so much it feels more like a memory. See, I never thought I'd live to see past 20. You know, I'm thinking about my little cousin Trey being murdered at the age of 19 when I'm speaking those lines, so I'm picturing his face.
Tron felt at home with this story.
The bleeding and the fighting between all the reading and writing, you know. So he's going into that place of protecting the people and being there for him. And that's where I go to. Like, you know, you see my stature. I'm a little guy, you know what I'm saying? But, you know, I've been a protector all my life.
Aaron Burr, the man who committed treason, is played by Science. That's his nickname.
Burr wants to rectify him being a villain. You know, he doesn't want the book of life to close on him as a villain. I mean, his life just simply took a downward spiral, but he didn't want to end that way. You know, the very last song is "Who Lives, Who Dies, Who Tells Your Story." Mm-hmm. And I think, though, even though I'm sentenced in prison, I still can write my narrative. You know, it's this small window in my life where I've made this mistake that I strive to reconcile, that I strive to make an atonement. Now you're calling me amoral, a dangerous disgrace. If you got something to say, name a time and place, face to face.
Now Science most wants to contribute to community. The Hamilton Project further inspired his education to become a paralegal.
I think the greatest part of being an American citizen is diving in and getting your hands dirty to help create in the society that you want to see. You know, so I'm very focused on leaning towards constitutional law when I'm done. My last exam, I received 100, you know, so I'm striving. You do have men here who may never be going home, but if they can pour into the life of individuals who are going home, especially and particularly in this choir, then I think they've done their civic duty.
For Culture Couch, this is David Seitz.
Support for Culture Couch is made possible by a generous grant from the Ohio Arts Council. I'm Jerry Kenney. You're listening to Why So Weekend. Thanks again for joining us. On Dayton Youth Radio this week, we had a Christmas story from Darius and Ace Coleman, a student at the Dayton Early College Academy. Here's Project Coordinator Basim Blunt to introduce our story.
Before you spend too much time wondering what to give that teenager on your holiday shopping list, you should listen to this story first by Darius Coleman, who says his parents always brought him everything he wanted.
My name is Darius Coleman. I'm 16, born and raised in Dayton, Ohio. I go to a school called Decker High.
I play football, had a perfect season, 0-10.
I live with my mom, Janae. I go to my dad's house every other weekend. His name is Anthony.
My story is about always being spoiled and just getting anything I really wanted, but I always just like ended up breaking whatever it was. I just got like bad luck with just taking care of stuff. I got so many examples of just being spoiled. I'm always told I'm getting spoiled. My sister even calls me spoiled butt all the time.
Both my parents make good money, so I'm blessed to never have to worry about money troubles or not having food on the table when I get home. My dad's the main one that spoils me, like in 2011, when he got me an ATV on my 8th birthday. An ATV is like a big dirt bike. It was a yellow camo one. It cost like $500. I didn't have it for too long, though. Me and my cousin, Lil Craig, he let me drive it. 20 seconds later, the ATV was just destroyed. In 2012, during Christmas, he got me another ATV. This one was red and white, super bad. But my cousin Boo Boo, he broke it during one of Dad's bonfires. I still know how to drive it, though. I remember breaking like 4 or 5 tablets, like Samsung ones, just from cracking the screen, dropping one in water. One, I think I just straight up lost it. I got a hoverboard. The thing was strong. But unfortunately, I lost the charger to it, and now just sitting in the side of my room, collecting dust. Dad got me this dog. I don't remember what the dog's name was, and it just used to destroy everything. Used to pee all over the house. One day, I just went to Dad's place, and he was like, I got rid of the dog. He just said that he was walking it, then he just gave it to some kid. Just never heard back from that kid, never heard anything about the dog. Whatever. In 2011, I remember like 2 more dogs. They would poop, eat the poop, and I don't know why, because I always gave them food. I was like, man, we don't have to lose another one of these. After about 2 or 3 weeks of having them, we just gave them to some other family. And I was happy with that. I didn't really want those 2 dogs. This year for my birthday, I turned 16. My mom got me my first car. It's a 2006 Jeep Grand Cherokee. I remember on the first day when my brother just dropped it off at mom's place, handed me the keys, I just jumped out the house, straight into the car, turned the key, then just started just bumping music. All I did was just listen to music. I messed up the car in the first like 5 minutes of having it. The battery broke somehow.
If you're like spoiled already, don't do the same things I did. Just be a little bit more responsible.
Right now, I'm trying to get a job just so I can support myself and be able to pay for gas and stuff like that. So I just turned in about like 3 or 4 applications to Walmart, Dollar Tree, and Save-A-Lot. So hopefully I get hired pretty soon. My family has always been there for me, giving me stuff, always supporting me, dealing with all the stuff I break. I know they love me anyway. I love them, and I don't know what I would do without them. But
I am looking forward to Christmas.
I'm gonna get to know you better this Christmas. And
for Dayton Youth Radio at DECA, this is Darius Coleman.
Fireside is blazing bright.
That's a story entitled Land of Plenty, written and produced by Darius Ace Coleman, a junior at the Dayton Early College Academy. Special thanks to Ann Rasmussen at DECA. For Dayton Youth Radio, this is Basim Blunt.
presents and cards are here. My world is filled with cheer and you. This Christmas, and as I look around, your eyes outshine the town they do. This Christmas, the fireside is blazing bright. We're caroling through the night.
Find more Dayton Youth Radio stories on our website at WYSO.org. I'm Jerry Kenney. If someone has stroke symptoms and calls 911, every minute matters. One Ohio City is using a customized ambulance to bring help fast. Side Effects Public Media's Paige Flager reports.
Paramedic Scott Widener crouches in the back of a specially outfitted ambulance.
I am 6 foot. And I'm ducking.
It's first thing in the morning, and his team in Columbus, Ohio, is already hard at work, checking equipment and preparing for their 12-hour day.
Extra drugs, pumps, IV tubing, just different things that we carry for if we do encounter a stroke patient. So this is all truck checks, make sure everything's here, accounted for, working in proper order, ready to go in case we get a run.
A run means somebody has called 911 reporting stroke symptoms. A regular ambulance will show up too, but that ambulance doesn't have the expertise of Widener's team, which includes two specially trained paramedics, a nurse practitioner, and a CT tech. Plus,
CT scanner's the biggest. This rolls out, this cot comes up, and the, you know, their head goes right in there, obviously.
The large donut-shaped scanner is the reason for the mobile stroke unit's existence, one of only about 20 in the country and 30 in the world. It can identify on the scene if someone is having a stroke, and if so, what kind. There are two kinds of strokes. 15% are caused by a brain bleed. 85% stem from a blood clot in the brain. For clots, patients get a drug called IVTPA, but that medication cannot be given to patients that have brain bleeds.
The nickname for TPA is clotbuster. You know, so if you're getting a clot-busting medication, that is a medicine that can potentially cause bleeding. So if you already have bleeding in the brain, giving TPA on top of that would be catastrophic.
That's Dr. B.J. Hicks, who helps direct the stroke program at Ohio Health Riverside Methodist Hospital and is the physician in charge of the mobile unit. But that CT scanner is too expensive to put in every ambulance. And while it exists in a typical hospital setting, Hicks explains the time it takes to get there can be dangerous, even deadly.
So unlike almost any other medical emergency, stroke is very time dependent. Because you lose up to 2 million neurons per minute of having a significant when you have a significant stroke.
Strokes are the leading cause of paralysis in the U.S. and the fifth leading cause of death. Every minute saved in delivering stroke treatment can add a day onto a person's life. The team is collecting their own data, keeping track of patients for up to 8 months after their stroke to compare their outcomes to people who didn't use the unit. They've already treated more than 40 strokes in their first 6 months.
Our hope is that in 5-10 years from now, there's going to be mobile stroke units, just like there's EMS in all sorts of towns around the country. This is where we want to be in the future, and we're just extremely happy that Columbus is on the cutting edge.
Respond on 9 EMS 1, EMS 17, stroke 1. Straighter.
At the sound of the alarm, the team hops Riverside into the unit. Five. CT tech Jessica Swaggart makes sure the machine is locked into place.
This keeps it stationary as the truck's moving.
The CT scanner is kind of your baby, right?
Yeah.
The flashing lights turn on, illuminating a sign on the garage door that says, "You got this." Then the mobile unit hits the streets. For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Paige Flager.
That's it for this edition of WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, building a more informed community with independent news and storytelling. Many of our stories today were created at the Eichelberger Center for Community Voices at WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenney. We'll be back next Sunday morning at 10. Coming up now on WYSO, it's Vic McCunis with the Book Nook.
Christmas, fireside is blazing bright.